And when foundations and others began to start funding human rights in places like Indonesia, this is what I call an epistemological shift in the way that the social sciences have to begin apprehending the post-colonial world. And they have to begin reevaluating the relationship between order and stability and rights in a way which is very different than it had been up until that point. And it's very clear in the case of Indonesia. I cite some Ford Foundation officials who are meeting with other foundations that are starting to get into doing human rights work, who ask, you know, is there a sort of necessary level of repression in Indonesia that we need to see in order for there to be economic growth? And to the extent that they said no, then they were willing to begin funding human rights work. But they did so in ways that get to my sort of third argument, which is that the way that human rights politics emerges in Indonesia very much helped to frame the sort of Western engagement with human rights. So organizations like the Ford Foundation and other early sort of sponsors of what we now think of as human rights activism in Indonesia started their work by funding local legal aid societies in Indonesia. Now, legal aid, as I note in the paper, was a way of engaging with the politics of development which wasn't challenging the basic legitimacy of the regime. And the Suharto regime had come to power saying that its goal was to rapidly modernize state and society, and that everything else sort of flowed from this, including their sort of abolition of party politics and lots of other things which they felt justified the abrogation of civil and political rights. And so the early legal aid societies, which later become sort of more full-fledged human rights organizations, they have to couch their legal aid work within the framework of the regime's sort of modernizing ideology, and say that what we're really trying to do is to facilitate popular participation in national development projects. And so the legal challenges to the regime were in the guise of trying to essentially force the regime to take seriously its own rhetoric in order to stop repressing peasants and other poor people who were trying to participate in national development projects. And so, for example, one of the early cases of the Institute for the Defense of Human Rights that was formed in 1966 was to defend peasants who have been who basically been attacked for refusing to pay their debts that they had taken on in order to start growing the sort of miracle rice which is coming into Indonesia in the early 1970s. And so, by defending sort of peasants who are being harassed or arrested for being unable to fully participate in the regime's sort of agricultural modernization policies, they thought that this was a way of critiquing the sort of legal practices of the regime without undermining its basic legitimacy, both for practical reasons and because this was a way of talking about rights which resonated with broader public conceptions of social justice, which were deeply rooted in notions of economic justice. The fourth thing I'd like to raise is that all of these debates were very closely bound up in the relationship between foreign and Western NGOs, and that foreign NGOs tended to see what they were doing as very narrow in focus. That those who were funding and beginning to participate in supporting human rights work in Indonesia, Amnesty International, International Committee for the Red Cross, International Commission of Jurists, and others, they viewed what they were doing in a very sort of narrow, sort of pincers movement sort of way, supporting those who are advocating very narrowly around problems of political prisoners and around issues of detention practices and to some degree labor rights. Whereas in Indonesia, those organizations such as the Indonesian Legal Aid Society, or LBH, which becomes the most important human rights organization in Indonesia, always have a much broader conception of human rights within their purview. And those that are beginning to mobilize around rights claims in the mid-70s, student organizations and the like, always view civil and political rights as just one part of a much broader spectrum of rights for which they're struggling. And they're rooting their rights claims in a sort of critique, not just of the authoritarian character of Suharto's regime, but also in its dependence upon Western governments for economic assistance and the like. They root it in a critique of the global political economy and in an understanding of the sort of structural demands of international institutions and Western governments that privilege economic growth above social justice, or privilege economic growth over social justice. And so I cite a couple of examples of this in the paper, where student organizations and the like are suggesting that human rights in Indonesia can only be seen in this sort of broader global context. It can't just be about civil and political rights. It has to be about rights seen in their totality, and that we shouldn't arbitrarily try and disconnect them as scholars, even though if we focus too much on international institutions, we presume that because there's this division, you know, in the covenants and everywhere else, that everyone in other parts of the world saw things the same way and organized around things the same way. But the experience of Indonesia shows that this is simply patently untrue, and that we have to try and recover those conceptions of human rights from the inside out and take very seriously Indonesia's sort of alternate understanding of how they fit into the global human rights framework in order to get at this more accurately. The last thing I want to say is that I think that my paper speaks to the question of sort of agency and directionality, and that we often think that expanding conceptions of rights are driven either from the West against Islamic countries or whatever, and that these are often driven by sort of Western NGOs competing with other Western NGOs to expand the ambit of rights. In Indonesia's case, I think this paper suggests that the agency for expanding conceptions of rights is coming very much from Indonesians, environmental activists, feminist activists who are critiquing the government's coercive birth control and family planning programs, and others who are basically forcing Western NGOs to acknowledge a much broader conception of social justice than they themselves are willing to acknowledge through their own activism. And I think that this suggests that we as historians have a whole lot more work to do to try and begin recovering the diversity of perspectives in the post-colonial world about human rights without falling into the trap of labeling this, you know, cultural relativism or Asian human rights debates and thinking about this from the perspective of states who are arguing that we have this, you know, we have to prioritize, you know, collective good over individual rights, and therefore states can violate the rights of their citizens. Whereas if we pay attention to the sources that are available to us within NGOs and popular media and the like in places like Indonesia, we can get a better sense of the ways in which they themselves are forming alternate conceptions of rights, both in opposition to their own governments, but also in dialogue and sometimes opposition to the broader human rights community that we tend to think of as driving the debate rather than being engaged in a dialogue and sometimes a contest with human rights NGOs and those engaged in human rights work, but under a broader rubric in post-colonial societies like Indonesia.